today, journalist Mary-Ann Seacart on why women are still taken less seriously than men. For the past 3 years, Mary-Ann Seacart, a journalist, columnist and broadcaster, has been trying to find out why so often women are presumed to be less capable than men. She decided to speak to those who have made it to the very top of their professions, but still aren't immune to the prejudices experienced by women everywhere, every day.
Mary McAleese, when she was President of Ireland, led a delegation to the Vatican to meet the Pope, who's John Paul II.
And he reached across me, straight past me, and he went to reach for my husband's hand. And as he did so, he said to my husband, "Would you not prefer to be President of Ireland rather than married to the President of Ireland?" The delegation were stunned. I mean, nobody... The Pope laughed quite heartily, thought he had made a joke. And I then reached and took this hand that was hovering in midair, and I said, "Let me introduce myself. My name is Mary McAleese. I am the elected President of Ireland, elected by the people of Ireland, whether you like it or whether you don't."
And the Pope said afterwards, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was just joking. I heard you had a good sense of humour." And she said, "I do have a good sense of humour, but that wasn't funny and you wouldn't have said it to a man."
The joking line, oh, it's actually my least favourite. Ugh, you know.
That always makes me so angry. Haven't you got a sense of humour? And the trouble is, with all these sorts of behaviour, if you do challenge them, either the man, it's generally a man, not always, but either the man will deny it and say, "Oh, no, I didn't do that, or I didn't mean that." Or, in other words, he'll sort of gaslight you. Or he'll say, "I was just joking."
Mary-Ann wanted to try and understand a phenomenon she calls the authority gap, where women are routinely belittled or presumed to be ignorant, even if they are the most influential and accomplished on earth. Like Mary McAleese.
He didn't see things ever from a female perspective.
Or Bernardine Evaristo.
So on the outside, you'd think, well, this is somebody who walks with authority, but actually that's not how I'm treated by society.
Hillary Clinton.
They would say, "Would you ever vote for a woman?" I'd say, "Of course I would, just not that woman," meaning me.
The author, Kamala Shamsie.
And I think men are more interested in the lives of men. I think it's just that basic.
University Vice Chancellor, Mamaketi Pakeng.
They don't trust your authority, so they want to make decisions for you.
Or Professor Olivette Atelli.
And then you move on, you keep doing your thing, and you develop a very thick skin.
Mary-Ann argues that if it happens to them, all women are vulnerable to it, and there is the evidence to prove it. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why the authority gap persists and what can be done to close it. Mary-Ann, you've written about the authority gap that exists between men and women, and your career has seen you work typically in very male-dominated environments. You began working in journalism in the 80s. What was that like for you at the time as a woman? You know, what are your memories of that?
It was quite hard, actually, because I was an assistant editor of The Times, which meant that I was one of the people who went to morning conference when the newspaper is sort of planned and put together. And I think there were 22 people at morning conference, of whom only two of us were women. So if Bridget, the features editor, wasn't there, I was the only woman in the room. And it's a very, very competitive, quite aggressive atmosphere. And I realised from the start that I could either play a traditionally feminine role and be demure and be completely rolled over on the first day, or I could act just as confidently as the men and act as if I had just as much right to be in the room as the men. And I would be taken seriously, but I would also be disliked because people don't like women behaving as confidently as men. But if they don't behave as confidently as men, they don't get taken seriously. So it's a real double bind that women find themselves in.
It definitely is. And you were a columnist, and for a while, Private Eye magazine actually ran a parody column written by a Mary-Ann Bighead. You know, how did you feel about that at the time?
I just thought the subtitle could have been "Woman, Know Your Place." Because really, I was no more big-headed than my male colleagues. In fact, I think I was less big-headed.
I mean, I imagine that the way you've been treated throughout your career motivated you to write this book in lots of ways. And the book looks at how even women in very powerful positions, like some of the most powerful women in the world, still struggle with everyday sexism. Why did you want to write about the authority gap? Why did you want people to read about this?
Because I wanted to show the objective evidence that proves it to be true. I really wanted to give women ammo, actually. I wanted to give women the ammunition to say to their colleagues and their bosses and the men in their lives, look, this is a real thing. This really exists. And please let's do something about it.
You say you wanted to give women ammunition through objective evidence, and your book has a wealth of that. You reference studies and investigations that look at different aspects of the authority gap, and you found that it influences all of us and what people think of us from a very young age. Tell me about some of the work that you looked at into this.
The one that most shocked and depressed me, actually, was that British parents, when asked to estimate their children's IQ, put their boys, on average, at 115, which in itself is pretty funny because the average ought to be 100, right? Boys at 115 and girls at only 107, despite the fact that girls develop faster, have a bigger vocabulary, do better at school. So they are implicitly treating their boys as cleverer than their girls.
And a lot of this is about how clever we seem to be. You also talked about the science behind bluster. Did you find that women being able to bluff works for them or against them?
Men are much more likely to bullshit than women. And there was a great study done of teenagers, both male and female, and they were given a list of mathematical concepts and they had to say whether they understood them, were very confident about them, you know, on a spectrum. And three or four of the concepts were actually fake ones. And boys were much more likely than girls to say they were very confident in dealing with mathematical concepts, even though they didn't exist. And because men are much more likely to blag their way through life, we take them at their estimation. And that's the mistake we make. Whereas if a woman doesn't self-promote and sees her abilities much more accurately, which is, after all, what we're taught to do, what we're socialised to do from childhood as girls, people believe her too. And if she self-deprecates, they believe her. So if she's modest about her achievements, we think she's not very good. If a man boasts about his achievements, we think he's brilliant. And they may be exactly the same, or she may indeed be better than him.
Alongside the data, you also interviewed a host of famous and very powerful women about their experiences of the authority gap. We've heard Mary McAleese at the start of this podcast, and you spoke to many who work in the world of politics, but also several prominent female writers. One of those was Booker Prize winning author Bernardine Evaristo. What did she tell you about her experiences of the authority gap?
Well, yes, she was fascinating on this, on the intersectional aspects of it, because she's female, she's black, she's working class, came from a working class background. And as you say, she's a fabulous novelist and professor of creative writing. And she says, people never treat me with the authority that I deserve, given my position in the world.
It's a societal issue about how women are treated. I remember being in a restaurant with one of my students. We were having a tutorial outside of the university, and she was 21, a young white girl. And the waitress came up and asked her for the order and then gave her the bill.
No.
Now, I'm a woman in my 50s at that stage, but I was a black woman, so I was invisible to her. So I think I always have to work hard to get the authority that I think is automatically conferred on other people. For example, I teach at a university and I have my email signature, which everybody has, and I make sure I put all my honours and acronyms after my name. Because I know that in a university system, which is very hierarchical, it will give me the authority that people wouldn't necessarily, think I'm entitled to.
Exactly. And also her experiences speak particularly as well to, you know, the publishing industry and how difficult it is for women and for black women especially to break through there as well. I mean, even when she won the Booker Prize, she was sharing it with Margaret Atwood.
Absolutely. And she only won, she says, because of who was in the room, because I think there were four female judges and one male one. And that made all the difference. You know, they were determined actually to accord more authority for once to female writers. Kamla Shamsi, the novelist, she was on a judging panel.
We were sitting down for the first meeting and I think there was a list of past winners and I sort of looked at it and said, only one woman or only two women. And when we came in to meet next time, all the writers had to bring in a certain, you know, had to have read all the books and chosen the books that they thought should be in contention for the shortlist. And one of the male judges, you know, had a couple of women. And when he was asked about one of the books by a woman, why he was backing it, he sort of shrugged and looked at me and said, well, because such a noise was made on the first day about women not being included. And it was clear he hadn't read the book.
No.
He'd just thrown it on his list. But then the really telling thing was it got onto the long list because others of us, which is to say women, had read it and really liked it. And when we came in for the next meeting, this male judge was a very passionate advocate of this book, which he had finally read and found to be wonderful. You know, I don't even know what to do in this situation.
I've written a whole chapter about how it's not just that some men don't accord authority to what we women say or write. It's that they don't even listen to us in the first place. They don't read our books. They don't follow us on Twitter. So how can they even tell whether what we're doing is authoritative if they're not even reading or listening to it?
I mean, it really is shocking and very depressing, that story. Back to the world of politics, though, you also, while writing the book, got the chance to speak about the authority gap to a woman who I think's experienced it in a much more blatant way than some of us, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. What did she have to say about it?
So it was when the Democratic primary was still running.
So your book could not be more timely because we have, you know, three women who are really in contention now for the potential of getting the nomination. And they're different. So it's not just one woman standing alone on the stage, as I did in 2008 and 2016. You know, they look different, they dress different, they talk different. So accustoming the public to different styles of women on the public stage is critically important. I practiced law 100 years ago. And I practiced law with a lot of different male lawyers. They all had different styles. I mean, you know, there was the very elegant trial lawyer who was beautifully attired and very soft-spoken. And then there was the sloppy guy who, you know, raised his arms and ran around and ruffled up his hair. And they each had their own strengths. But they were not viewed as outliers. They were viewed as, you know, there's Joe and there's Jack and they're two men lawyers. Whereas when I would try cases, sometimes I'd have the judge say, well, you're looking so pretty today. So stand up here and turn around, show everybody, show the jury, show everybody how pretty that dress is. That never happened. Oh, you've got a great tie on today. Show everybody that tie. So those things are not maybe so blatant, but the underlying motivation and sensation are still present. So it's going to take some time to, you know, break through that highest and hardest glass ceiling.
And I think that really sums up that, you know, a lot of people in opinion polling said that every single woman running for the Democratic nomination was unlikable. Now, what are the chances that all those women were unlikable? Wasn't that actually saying more about the voters themselves and how they respond to the idea of a woman seeking power, they don't like it, than the women themselves?
There was one particular part of your book that did pique my interest, which again is around how women present themselves, and that's about women's voices and how seriously women are taken depending on the pitch and the tone of their voice. And I've always thought that having a slightly deeper voice has helped me because it makes you feel like you maybe have more authority. Is that really true? Is that what perceptions of women tell us?
Yes, we do tend to associate lower voices with authority. You know, a woman talking in a high voice tends to sound quite childish, and we don't associate childishness with authority. But what I found fascinating was that the average pitch of a woman's voice in more egalitarian countries has dropped dramatically over the past few decades, whereas in inegalitarian countries such as Japan, it remains still pretty high. But women, you know, women just know instinctively you need to lower your voice if you want to be listened to. I mean, we all know famously Margaret Thatcher took voice training.
I'm very much aware of the responsibilities and a little bit apprehensive. Who wouldn't be?
Feel very strongly about it. The greatest divisions this nation has ever seen.
But I know female politicians I talk to, Margaret Hodge, I remember saying, you know, I deliberately lower my voice when I'm talking in the chamber because I know what a difference it makes.
Dame Margaret Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I congratulate my right honourable friend member for Sutton Coldfield for raising the issue.
And there was one aspect of your research that I found particularly interesting, really interesting, which is where you looked at the different experiences of men and women through those who've transitioned from male to female or vice versa. What did you find out from speaking to trans men and women about the authority gap?
I think I found this the most interesting chapter to write because universally, trans men said after they transitioned, I'm just taken so much more seriously now. And trans women had exactly the opposite experience. So two very interesting examples. Two middle-aged professors at Stanford happened to be transitioning in opposite directions at the same time. Ben Barres, once he became known as Ben, said, I've had the thought a million times, I'm just taken more seriously now. The same damn work, as he put it, my work, the same damn work is taken more seriously now than it was before. Someone who didn't know his history was heard saying at the back of one of his seminars, oh, Ben Barres gave a great seminar today, but then he's so much better than his sister. His sister being him.
Oh, my gosh.
Meanwhile, Joan Roughgarden started living as a woman. When she was living as a man, she was on the University Senate Committee. Everything she said was taken seriously. She was treated with great respect. When she started living as a woman, she said that gradually her relative pay started falling. She wasn't renewed on the University Senate Committee. She found it much harder to get grants, and her work was attacked, and she was attacked personally in a way that she said had never happened to her when she was living as a man. People said things like, you haven't read the literature and you're not smart enough. And she was absolutely horrified by this. But the great thing about this the experiences of trans people is that they are exactly the same person with the same ability, intelligence, experience, personality, body of work. And the only variable that has changed is their gender. So you have isolated the one variable that matters. Now, of course, part of this may be transphobia. And perhaps, you know, Joan didn't pass as easily as Ben did. But on the other hand, Ben did experience that huge increase in respect. And I think that alone tells us that it is just a hell of a lot easier to be a man than a woman.
Your book is about the authority gap, and because of that, you've spoken to people in positions of authority. And in doing so, most of them are from a particular elite in many ways. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, a lot of them didn't start from a particular elite. They just got there in the end. A lot of them had working class backgrounds. But what I wanted to show was that if the authority gap has been experienced even by women right at the very top, then that's pretty good proof that it happens to all the rest of us. But I did also actually interview a lot of women who weren't very successful and authoritative.
Sort of trickles down, doesn't it? Women are still going to be experiencing this in, say, service sector jobs. Like, the authority gap surely exists in all of these places. I just wondered why you didn't give more prominence, I suppose, to women in those areas as much as women sort of in positions of power.
You know, the point was, we all know this happens to all of us in any job, but it's sort of easier to prove if you say this even happens when you've supposedly been accorded authority by the world, then it definitely happens to all the rest of us.
You also write about the multiplying factors of inequality, whether you're talking about women of colour or women with disabilities. What kind of evidence did you find of how much more severely this issue of the authority gap affects those groups?
What I found was that when women are asked, you know, do you have to prove your competence more than men? Do you find yourself being interrupted or talked over? All these manifestations of the authority gap are higher for women of colour and higher for women with disabilities. and sometimes, though not always, higher for lesbian and bisexual women. Women with disabilities get treated the absolute worst. And, you know, they really struggle to be taken seriously. And women of colour also suffer, well, obviously they suffer the bias in the first place, but they also suffer from extra stereotypes, which white women don't suffer from, such as the angry black woman or the demure Asian woman. And also, you know, if you're a black woman and you do speak out about this sort of treatment, suddenly you're labelled an angry black woman. And you're quite legitimately angry. I talked to Mamohetie Pakeng, who is Vice-Chancellor of the University of Cape Town.
Here's the point. Why shouldn't I be angry? Think about it. If you have anyone, and just take it if they were your daughter, they grow up in a country that's been colonized, they grow up in apartheid, they grow up in poverty, they fight. All your life you are fighting. Why shouldn't black people, black women be angry when they are still at the end of what I call the colonial procession? Why? You should be surprised that we are not angry. We should be more angry. In fact, we are very peaceful.
Class is something you haven't mentioned, but, you know, obviously being working class is much harder than being middle class. Having the wrong accent in this country in particular means that people are less likely to take you seriously sometimes. So, you know, if you are, for instance, as Bernardine Evaristo says, if you're black and female and working class, all these things compound to make life even harder for you. Olivetta Teller, who is professor of the history of slavery at Bristol University, she told me that when she attends an academic conference with some of her students, people always assume that she's a mature student.
Although I look my age, some people still think sometimes that I'm a mature student. So you would have even group colleagues, you have in a group, you take a student to a conference and they talk to students and then they address you and somebody will tell how brave you are, you know, to have gone back and studied.
Yeah.
Nowhere at any time did you tell them that you'd gone back and studied.
Yeah.
They just assume you've gone back and studied, you're with a bunch of students. No, actually, I'm there, their lecturer. So. Oh, you lecture them. Oh, well done, you. Oh, gee, thanks.
You know, it's the underestimation of black women that is so infuriating for them.
And you think that, you know, when you're talking in this book, you know, so often about the struggles of all women, and you look back at it, the history of feminism as a movement over the years has had to grapple with perhaps a focus, like what should the main focus be if the movement should have a single focus at all. You know, do you think that the authority gap for professional women is should be a priority for feminism in 2021?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, of course, there are all sorts of terrible problems that beset women all over the world. But I don't want to get into whataboutery, you know. I think we should care about all inequality which relates to women. And, you know, the more the better, frankly.
Coming up, the lessons we all need to learn to close the authority gap. But are they enough to actually change things for the better? Maryam, throughout your book, you make the point that this is not just about men's biases against women, but women's biases against women. It's something I recognise in myself, and I think this just shows how pervasive these prejudices are. And it's quite a difficult one for women to reckon with in a way, isn't it?
It is. And I was really struck by how many of the studies that I cite show female unconscious bias as well as male. So, for instance, one was of the researchers sent out an application for a lab manager position to top science professors, both male and female, in American universities. And both the male and female professors were more likely to say they would hire the person if it had a male name at the top than if it had a female one, and offered them a higher starting salary. So exactly the same application, with a male and a female name, and the women were just as biased as the men. Because the trouble is that we have all been brought up with the same sneaky little stereotypes, and so we are more likely to associate male with authority.
You provide a lot of advice for men on how they can behave differently to close the authority gap. But in your book, you also acknowledge that statistically, men don't typically buy books that are written by women. Are you worried that they won't read this one?
No, I really want this book to be read by men as well as women. Of course I want women to read it, but I don't think we'll change the world unless and until men read it too, or at least men are aware of what's in it. So I was very keen to have a cover that I thought would appeal as much to men as to women. I vetoed pink and curly writing and all that sort of thing.
Did they try to make the book pink?
Do you know, the very first design that the designer came up with had pink in it. The publisher didn't dare show it to me because she knew how angry I would be. So I was very keen for the cover to be the sort of cover that a man would not feel embarrassed being seen reading on the tube, which in itself proves the point of the book. Why should it be embarrassing to read a book by a woman? And I wanted to call myself M.A. Seacart rather than Marianne, rather like J.K. Rowling, as a sort of in-joke. But in the end, I was dissuaded from that. But I also said, I really want two quotes by men recommending the book on the cover and two by women, not two. And my publisher said, oh, but it's, you know, it's probably women who are going to buy this book. And I said, no, I really want men to buy this book. And sadly, again, proving the point of it, they're much more likely to do so if it's a man recommending it than if it's a woman.
Oh, gosh. What a minefield. Finally, Marianne, with all that you've learned both through writing this book and your career, what would your advice be to younger women, perhaps say in that same position you were in that conference meeting 30 years ago? What would you say to them now?
Well, I would say at least you've got some female role models now, which I didn't have. There was no woman more senior than me whom I could either emulate or ask advice from. So that's a start. I think you do have to be confident and to speak out, but you have to ladle so much warmth on top of that in order for it to work. So you need to smile a lot. You need to make jokes. I'm afraid you somehow got to be careful not to dent men's egos. And it's terrible that this burden should be put on women and not on men. But hey, that's the way the world is. And if you want to get on, I'm afraid that's probably how you have to do it.
Yeah, it's still very depressing, isn't it?
It is.
Because what I was just thinking is that, do you ever worry that is obviously advice that is good because it works for so many women, but do you think it perpetrates the stereotype in a way and reinforces it?
Yes. Yes and no. On the other hand, what's the alternative? You know, the alternative is that you don't make any compromises and you lose out as a result, tragically.
Mm. I hope anyway that a lot of young women are starting to think differently about that. I just think, as you know too well, the world changes very, very slowly.
Yeah, and you've got to get young men wanting to change, you know, for their generation to be different. And that's what I hope this book will at least help to achieve.
Marianne, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
That was Marianne Seacart. Her book, The Authority Gap, is available to buy now, and you can get it at theguardianbookshop.com. You can also read a comment piece she wrote called Why Do So Few Men Read Books by Women? Find it at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alice Fordham. Sound design was by Dominic Fitzgerald. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.